Every couple of weeks or so, we love to check in with Eric Peters, automotive journalist par extraordinaire. I can't sing his praises more because I love the site, epautos.com, and I go there quite often and catch up on not only on transportation. And the reason why you had to focus a lot on transportation, we've experienced here in Southern Oregon, too, the gangrene control grid, the nudging that the state of Oregon, the state of California, and everybody else, they want to nudge you in certain directions with policy, and we'll write you hot checks for politically favored cars, even though they don't make sense. We're going to take taxpayer money. We're going to fund gangrene car chargers up and down the Interstate 5 corridor. You have to pay attention to this because this, I think, is really part of the control grid. And we haven't even talked about the smart meters yet, but, well, we've been talking about the smart meters a lot, just not with Eric Peters necessarily. Eric, welcome back. Great to have you on the show.
Great to be back, Bill.
Hey, tell us a little bit, first off, you wrote a couple of books, or a book or two, and I think that people should know about that, too.
Well, let's see. The two hardcover ones, there's Automotive Atrocities, which is considered a classic at this point. Wrote that, I guess, about in 2004, and it's about the various Edsels, both modern and previous, that were just should never have seen the light of day. Everything from the Chevy Vega with the unlined engine cylinders all the way up through the Pontiac Aztec.
Oh, I can't tell you how many people I knew that back when I was a kid, the Vega was a new vehicle at that point. And,
yep.
Oh, they, you know, burning oil, blowing head gaskets. I remember it well. And yet,
yep.
It was a great looking car. I have to tell you, it was a good idea. It just was not well executed.
Yeah,
you
know? It was kind of like a downsized Camaro. It had similar styling, but it was horrifically poorly engineered and rushed into production and had all sorts of catastrophic flaws. And I kind of regret that I wasn't around to review cars like that. I can't imagine how much fun it would have been to have gotten a brand new Vega to test drive and write about.
This is a pile of, and then just kind of kind of move on. Well, of course, my first family car that we had, 1971 Ford Pinto. So that was the that was with the built-in exploding gas tank and everything else. And in defense of the Ford Pinto, I know that he had the problem with the gas tank filler, which is famously there. That thing, we couldn't kill that car. I mean, even as the body rusted around all of the components, the thing always ran in those Ohio and Western Pennsylvania winters. You couldn't kill the car. It's a great car,
actually,
I thought.
The Pinto has an undeserved reputation for being a poor car, and it wasn't. Ford made millions of those things. And there was that potential issue with the fire if the car was struck extremely hard in the back. You had to really hit that thing hard, like 40, 50 miles an hour at least, to sever that fuel filler and potentially cause a fire. But the number of fires relative to the number of Pintos that were produced is extremely small. Ford shouldn't have cheaped out. They should have spent the extra $5 or $10 on the car. But the car itself was actually a pretty good car, unlike the Vega, which was a terrible car.
Yeah, we have to call it as it is. What concerns me, though, about a growing trend, and you write about on epautos.com, your latest article, I think, is a must-read. You entitled it, Proletarianizing, let me try this one more time.
Proletarianizing.
There we go. Proletarianizing the populace via mobility as a service. And this is something that you were kind of referring to this in some of our other conversations, but the big automobile companies seem to understand, or they know which side of their bread is buttered, and you're saying you don't think they're going to be able to sell us cars much longer the way it's been going because of Uncle Sam and others?
Well, yeah, they're kind of up against the wall. Toyota, the lead-in from my article is about Toyota's announcement the other day that they're investing something like $500 million in Uber, the ride-sharing service, and automated vehicle technologies. And the reason for this is that all these synergies are coming together that are making buying cars increasingly difficult for more and more people. The average car last year sold for $35,000. It takes 6-7 years on average now to finance a car. You can't finance it much beyond that because after about 5 or 6 years, the car is worth only about half what you paid for it.
Yeah, the banks and the credit unions won't touch it, sure.
Right. And then you've got, because of all the mandates that have been passed by the government, cars are now very, very expensive to repair. With the airbags, you have 6 airbags in the average new car. A couple of airbags go off in an otherwise repairable accident. The car's got thousands of dollars worth of damage before you even get into body work.
And even if you didn't have a lot of body work, the cost of the airbags is prohibitively expensive then. So they just total the car, right?
They total the car, and then that's reflected in the insurance premiums that we all pay, which are going up. I mean, if you talk to people and they'll tell you, boy, I just got something in the mail from my insurance company. It's, you know, it's going up again. I didn't get any tickets. Why is it? Well, it's because of the repair costs and also the disposability of cars. They're just being thrown away. Ultimately, somebody's got to pay for this. Well, the car companies are looking down the road and realizing that these trends are increasing rather than diminishing. And at some point, they're going to hit the wall and people aren't going to be able to buy cars anymore. So what's the solution? Well, the solution is to rent them cars. And that's what this mobility stuff is all about. Mobility is transportation as a service. Rather than own the car, you will simply rent a ride. That's what the future appears to be.
And this is way beyond Uber. You're almost talking about, from what it sounds like, is a corporatized service nationwide in various permutations in in cities, right?
All of the major car companies, GM, Ford, all of them, are all investing in this stuff. Because that's, you know, they've run the numbers and they realize that, you know, 5 years from now, this is going to be probably the only way that they can stay in business unless something changes with regard to the costs that are, you know, the things that are driving up the costs of cars. And the other angle of this, of course, is that it's going to be, you know, these automated cars. You know, you're not going to be a driver anymore. You're going to be a passenger. I used the term in my article, a bus for one. That's the future. You know, you're no longer going to have that spontaneity of being able to just, hey, I think I want to run down to the store, or I want to, you know, I feel like taking a drive today and just go out and jump in your car and go.
But yet, to me, that is America. That is what made America great.
Sure.
I mean, sorry to borrow Trump's phrase there, but
he's right.
That was part of what made America great, that freedom, because you look at the history of America and we've been a rambling people. We're restless. You know, we wanted to, the whole idea, even you listen to so much of our rock and roll and pop music, it was like, a tank of gas in an open highway and you hit the road, right?
Well, it was about being an individual and, you know, being in control of your individual destiny. I use the term prole in the headline of my article because it's a reference to the Soviet proles who were characterized by constantly standing in one dreary line after the next. To be treated as a great faceless mass.
Yeah, and to buy to buy lousy toilet paper, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's what differentiated this country from countries like Russia. But unfortunately, it seems that we're heading in the direction of Russia, you know, rather than trying to preserve what made America great.
I find it fascinating that Russia reestablishes Christianity through the Orthodoxy, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church, and they're talking about, you know, no one's going to tell Vlad Putin that he can't drill for oil, right? And yet you look at the difference in here, and it's like, oh, we can't drill for oil, we can't do this, oh, we can't have a car, oh, we certainly can't have Christianity. Not that I'm shilling for Christianity, but you understand, you know, where I'm coming from. It does seem like there's a strange role reversal going on between the West and the East at this point.
There is, and it's tragic. Right now, and this is not an exaggeration, in terms of everyday freedom, I think that the average Russian is freer than the average American. He's not constantly being nudged, pestered, harassed, mulcted, caged, and imprisoned for all these petty little offenses that are now on the books that constrain us and prevent us from just doing what we want to do as rambling American individuals.
Now, to be fair, on the other side, you get sideways of Vlad, you could find yourself dead. You know,
you have to be a pretty big fish, I think. And this is sort of an elliptical defense of Putin. I think you'd have to be operating at that level, you know, to potentially be a threat. I don't think Vlad cares if you buckle up for safety. I don't think he cares if you want to ride your motorcycle without a helmet. And I don't think he cares if you want to jump in your car and go down the road on your schedule to see your friends or just go for a ride because you feel like going for a ride.
But the trend for a transportation as a service, though, is definitely one of those things where you are working on the car schedule, right?
Yes. Of course, it's inevitable. You have to be. You know, the car is not yours. It's not your property any more than a bus is. What do you do when you take the bus? You go down to the bus station. You stand there and wait. And when the thing gets there, then you get on. And then you're driven according to the schedule and the way that the driver wants to drive the bus. You have absolutely no control anymore over your mobility. Except if you want to, you know, hoof it and go on foot.
So do you think we're going to see the time, Eric, in which that the vast majority of people will just say, hey, I'm not going to bother buying a car any longer because I know many of the millennials right now are, well, I'd like to play with my phone. And boy, wouldn't it be great. I could have a self-driving car and then I could be in touch with my friends, you know, on social media. I'm being kind of sneering with that because I hear that even from my own son.
Sure.
So I could get away with saying
I've got some some of my friends have kids in that age group, and I've talked to them about it. And, you know, the reality is it's not so much that they dislike cars, it's that they can't afford them. They can't afford everything that goes with them. Think about what it costs to insure a car today. And because of all the safety stuff, it's very difficult to find, you know, the kind of car that you and I got when we were that age.
Well, we just talked about it when we first opened up. Remember that 1971 Ford Pinto? I remember it being advertised. This was a nationwide price, $19.19. That's what my family paid for it. I think they paid $50 more because it had an AM radio. That was a big option.
Exactly. And when we were in high school, you could go out and spend literally a couple hundred bucks, you know, $500-$600, and have a serviceable car. It might have been, you know, had the spring popping out of the seat and manual roll-down windows and no radio, but it was a functional car and it was yours. And you could afford it and you could afford to drive it. That's unfortunately not the case any longer. And so these kids are turning inward to their games and other such things because they've sort of realized, I can't do this.
There is no getting out on the road, on the open road with a tank of gas and freedom. And I think that there are those in the globalist control grid that kind of want it that way. They want us at the beck and call of automated. It's almost as if you and I were talking about this before we went on the air. Linda and I ended up coming across Logan's Run, that old movie. I never watched it when I was a kid. It was really campy. Yep. Wasn't necessarily all that great of a movie either. But be that as it may, I recall they had almost this futuristic look of people pods in which the cars would just show up on little rails, and then and then you would only go where the rails went between the various cities. You know, in a sense, that's kind of what the self-driving car is about, because they end up you end up having to go on government-programmed routes. That's really what would happen.
Of course. Of course. Now, and imagine how these things are going to be programmed, these automated cars. Do you suppose that they're going to be programmed to have initiative and verve and drive the way you or I would as a competent, speedy, fast-driving person? Or do you think they're going to probably approximate the way your mother-in-law drives?
It's going to be slow and safe is what they're going to claim. Mm-hmm. All right. This is going to be like those, remember those old football games, those electric football games that buzzed?
Yeah.
I have a feeling that my self-driving car would just go in a circle like that one quarterback I had.
Well, this is why I keep my orange Barchetta gassed and charged and at the ready. My orange Barchetta being my 76 Trans Am that's out in the garage.
It's interesting that you bring up this deal about the self-driving car and the future that they're trying to force upon you, because no one's been asking for it, really. It's almost been, it's just assumed that we're going to do this. We're going to have 5G, and 5G is part of the self-driving car issue there, too. I'm looking at this article today on CNBC. I hate them, it's titled. Locals reportedly frustrated with Alphabet. This is Google's self-driving cars.
That. Mm-hmm.
You
yep.
saw that? Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the self-driving cars are so ultra-paranoid that people are trying to drive around them, and that they really aren't as smart as people would like to say they are.
No, not only not smart, but they have to be that Mr. Magoo-like conservative, because if you think about the liability issues, you take the driver out of the equation. You or I, when we drive, if we drive in a reckless or irresponsible way, let's say, and we run somebody over or cause damage, we are personally liable, right? Well, when you are merely the occupant, I mean, if you're riding in a bus, you know, and the bus hits something, well, it's not your problem, you know, and you're not going to be sued for that. Well, it's the same principle with these automated cars. Who's going to be the responsible party when the software doesn't work or when the car has a hiccup and something goes wrong?
Hey, I wanted to ask you about that. Has there been any jurisprudence or anybody looking ahead? Who would be sued if the self-driving car, the autonomous car, supposedly self-described there, ends up getting into a wreck? Who's responsible then? Is it the software developer? I mean, who?
Yeah, I think it has to be whoever the owner is, whatever the entity is that has legal ownership or possession of the vehicle that you are merely renting or an occupant in. Mm. And that is the liable party. And as a result of that, they're programming these things to be extra cautious, extra safe, even when it's extra idiotic. You know, when the thing can't deal with, as in the article, a T-intersection or the presence of a double-parked car, and it just sits there. And you sit there because the thing doesn't know how to deal with that.
Eric Peters, once again, automotive journalist. It's a great article, Proletarianizing the Populace via Mobility as a Service. Fight for freedom here, folks. This is why he writes this sort of stuff. He gets you thinking about this, and I know it could be so convenient. I would not want any kind of self-driving or programmed vehicles around me unless everybody else is allowed to continue to drive as they do right now. And something tells me that eventually they're going to say, well, we can't bring this safety transportation utopia around as long as you're still driving your 77 Trans Am. Right.
Right, because it's unpredictable. Because whatever I'm thinking about doing, whether I'm thinking about going left here or straight or right, that is determined on the fly by my software, by what's in my head. And they don't have access to that. And they'll say, well, if a car isn't plugged into our hive mind network, then it's unsafe for all of the automated cars. That's the line of reasoning that they're going to use.
I would see this being used in large cities first, and then it would probably filter out to our less populated areas, such as at Medford or Grants Pass, a little bit later on, wouldn't you say?
Yep. And they're already actually installing bits and pieces of this technology in cars. It's not just our friend Elon and his autopilot. GM's Cadillac division has some similar technology in a number of their new Cadillacs, and a number of other more mundane everyday cars have little bits and pieces of this technology, you know, automated semi-automated steering, brakes that come on automatically and stuff like that, and I think it's purposeful. They're trying to habituate people to it, get them used to this stuff.
All right. Now, we're going to wrap it up here now because I'm just turning into a pumpkin, kind of like your car. All right. But I did want to touch on a couple of really cool things because you do great reviews. You had reviewed the Kias and the Hyundais, and you actually like what you saw. You were actually loving the value. You talk about the average car being $35,000. You can actually do okay, you know, on those.
Yep.
I also think we talked about the Chrysler Pacifica. Which is the not so minivan. Those minivans have actually gotten a lot bigger.
Enormous. It's almost as big as an old Buick Deuce and a Quarter 225 Electra.
I know. That's kind of what I was thinking about that. But what has been falling out of favor have been the sedans. And that's the problem with Elon Musk that you have talked about here before on the show, is that his electric supercar, they're all sedans. People don't want sedans. But the sedan makers are fighting back. And Toyota is something that you talk about here recently. Mm-hmm. What's that?
Yeah, well, the Camry, perennially best-selling Toyota Camry, has been radically redesigned for 2018. You look at it, and it's a really sexy-looking thing, a really sporty-looking thing. It looks a lot like the latest Lexus, in fact. But you know, going more than skin deep, the thing that I really like about it is that Toyota did not go the way everybody else is going, and you can still get a V6 in the thing. V6s are almost impossible to find anymore in cars under $30,000. And there's no turbo, not on the V6 and not on the standard four-cylinder engine, which makes almost as much power now as a lot of the four-cylinder turbo engines, but without the turbocharger.
Very good. So you're looking at possibly better reliability over time because it's one less part to break.
That's one of the things that sold the Camry over the years is that they're really hard to kill. They go for 200,000-300,000 miles, and they generally don't need much more than filling up the tires and changing the oil every now and again. They're really, really solid, good cars.
And that V6 from the Toyota, is that the same V6 that's in, we have a station has a 4Runner from 2002 that we can't kill it?
Well, it's an evolved version. It's a larger V6. It's 3.5 liters now, and it's making more than 300 horsepower.
Well, I wouldn't mind that. My 4Runner's a little pokey.
Well, this comparison. Family car, and the Camry is a family car. It's a family sedan. It gets to gets to 60 in 5.8 seconds with the V6, which, as you and I know, would have been considered supercar performance.
Oh my gosh!
Not all that long ago.
Boy, it's a far cry from my '87 Ford Tempo that I bought brand new when I was a young man, and I ended up getting the sports package, the GLS or whatever it is, and which meant you got the extra stripe down the side at that time. And I recall it was 0 to 60 in 12.2. Ooh.
Yeah, well, to really put it in perspective, my Trans Am back in 1976 was the fastest American production car with the 455 V8, and it did 0 to 60 in 7.2 seconds.
And so now a grocery getter, a Toyota Camry, regular old family car, blows it out of the water, right?
Blows it out of the water.
I'll bet you have a better engine note, though.
Oh, I have a better engine note, and of course, my 455 is no longer stock.
I had a feeling that was it. But we don't want to sick the Virginian authorities upon you, my friend. Thank you so much.
No.
Go to epautos.com and read up on it. Proletarianizing the populace via mobility as a service. I say no. Vote for freedom. Keep voting with your dollars on this one. And also laugh at these politicians that want to bring this this utopian future to you, okay? Eric, always a pleasure. Thanks again, my friend.
Thank you, Bill. Always enjoy it.
You bet. 729 to KMED.